The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for July 8th, 2017. It's been a week of controversial decisions in the bicycle world, and we are going to explore two of them today. Reigning world champion Peter Sagan was summarily dismissed from the Tour de France in Stage 4 when he allegedly caused a crash that took Mark Cavendish out of the race in the final sprint of the day. What followed was nothing less than mayhem. The ASO and UCI first decided that Sagan should be penalized and fined, then amended that decision and DQ'd him. Fini. Gone. He went home. The interwebs lit up like Christmas with protests and commentary, so we'll get the whole story and have a discussion about the pros and cons of this decision with Velo News journalist Dan Worry. Then we'd speak with USA Today sports writer Brent Scrotenboer. Brent has been covering the Lance Armstrong case for what probably seems like forever. His most recent article in the national paper is titled, Feds Explain Why It Is Targeting Lance Armstrong Alone in the Suit. USA Today of July 19th follows on the heels of several other articles pertaining to the case as the November trial date looms ahead. We'll ask Brent what exactly the feds do and don't want brought up in the case and why they are targeting Mr. Armstrong. Then we'll get the second of our controversial stories, bike attorney Bob Mianski, who's with BikeLaw.com, the national network of bicycle attorneys. He's out in Portland. He's going to discuss a bizarre case of legislative turnabout. Seems that an insurance company sued a cyclist by saying she backed into a car even though she was hit from behind. She was injured. The police failed to file their report. And we'll see what actually transpires in a case like this when Bob gives us some salient points to remember if we are involved in a crash. Finally, we have the second of our national bike challenge stories for you, this time from Germany. Yep, Gernot Sauter from Düsseldorf, Germany, works for NBC sponsor 3M, and his story ties right into the Tour de France as Germany hosted the opening of the event this year. So buckle up, folks. It's going to be a hilly ride. We're heading down to North Carolina to speak with Dan Worry. Hi, Dan. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks so much for joining me today. It's been an insane week at the Tour de France.
It has been a doozy.
Yeah, that's a good word. Well, let's see if we can sort out some of the UCI's ASO explanation for disqualifying our world champion, Mr. Peter Sagan, from the Tour de France this past week in the fourth stage.
Well, a couple of different things happened, so maybe we'll take a minute to sort of break them down. So first, there is the question of what is known as irregular sprinting. So anyone who's ever watched the Tour, and particularly a sprint finish, knows that these things are incredibly hectic, incredibly dangerous. And so I guess issue number one here is this question of keeping one's line, right? So the idea is that once the sprint begins, you kind of stay in your own imaginary lane. You sprint in a straight line. You don't veer all over the road, which obviously would be very dangerous. So during stage four, we had Mark Cavendish attempting to follow Arnaud Démare on a path sort of to Peter Sagan's right. So if you can imagine him riding toward the sprint finish here, he's got the barriers, the crowd barriers, a couple feet to his right. Démare passes him to the right, and as Cavendish comes up behind him, Sagan's path strays a bit to the right, and so that essentially traps Cavendish sort of up against the barriers where he eventually crashed. So, issue number one is this question of whether Sagan held his line. By most accounts, he did not. Now, in fairness, this is a really common thing. It plays out in, fractions of seconds. Sagan's hardly the only one who violated the rule, even during that particular sprint. Several riders probably could have been penalized theoretically, but, being penalized for an irregular sprint tends to happen, A, when it's really egregious, or B, when somebody gets hurt. And so, when a penalty like that is assessed, it usually entails what's called relegation. The rider's sprint is disqualified, and typically he or she is moved to last place on the stage. So you go from, contending for the stage win to being bumped all the way back. That's not a huge big deal for the sprinters because, they tend not to be in the mix for the general classification anyway. In the case of the Tour de France, you may be docked points in the green jersey competition for the best sprinter. That's initially what happened with Sagan. They relegated him to last place. They took away points in the green jersey competition, but then things got more dramatic, as the jury kind of went and looked. The bigger issue then is something that happened when the two of them collided. So just before Cavendish goes down, Sagan extends his right elbow in a way that when you're looking at the aerial photography and the long lens kind of photography from the finish, appeared maybe as though it was the cause of the crash. So the implication here, Diane, was that Sagan deliberately elbowed Cavendish and kind of took him down violently. There's a better video angle, though, at least in my estimation, that reveals otherwise. If you can imagine, riding in very tight quarters, you're about 2 feet from the barriers on your right, and then here comes Cavendish up behind you from Sagan's perspective. It appears on this video that Cavendish makes the first contact with Sagan. He leans into Sagan, and his handlebars appear to lodge under Sagan's right elbow. So at this point, Cavendish is already crashing and begins to tilt to the right. Sagan, as best I can discern from the video, may have actually had his elbow partially extended by Cavendish when his bike's handlebars come up behind and kind of push his arm out to the right. But ultimately it looks to me like Sagan lifts his elbow to try to kind of disentangle himself from the other guy's bike, and it's at that point that Cavendish goes down. But as best I can determine, and I think the best, most people can determine at this point, that the alleged elbow never even touched Cavendish. So there, in addition to the question of irregular sprinting, there's this second question of whether there was some malicious intent here for which the jury eventually threw him out of the race. Now, my best guess, Diane, is that the jury made this decision probably based on partial information, looking at those long shots and without the benefit of having a better angle. But the bottom line is, the sport's biggest star gets thrown out of its biggest race for having allegedly thrown an elbow that, as best I can tell, was never actually thrown and didn't even connect.
So there has been a lot of other video. There have been other videos. There has been a lot of controversy. I thought Peter Sagan handled it extremely professionally. I think that the officials handled it extremely unprofessionally. I'm not sure if there was other motivation or not. Do you think it was the wrong decision?
Oh, absolutely think it's the wrong decision. Really, it's outrageous. And I think, one of the problems here is that once the jury renders its decision, there is really no avenue for going back or no avenue to have a further appeal of that. And I do think as the day went on, as more video came out that it, you know, it became increasingly apparent that the jury had made the wrong decision. In fact, if you, you know, if you go out and look, you know, either on social media or in the, you know, in the press, I think at this point I'm yet to find a credible source that says the jury made the right decision. So, I mean, it's a pretty surprising move to have them throw him out. Although, you know, again, in fairness, from those other angles, you know, it certainly looked suspect. But I think, you know, the once you get a better look at it, you know, I think, you know, one indication here, Diane, is even, you know, Andre Greipel, who is one of the other sprinters in the peloton, you know, initially had very harsh words for Sagan, said their friendship was over. And, you know, I mean, it was a pretty dramatic statement that he made at the end of this based on what he thought had happened. And a couple hours later, he admitted on Twitter that he was wrong and, you know, said, you know, basically, I, you know, maybe I need to look at video next time before I open my big mouth. So, you know, even other sprinters at this point, you know, seem to, you know, not to back this decision.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dan Worry. We are talking about Peter Sagan being summarily rejected, sent home from the Tour de France for what has turned out to be probably not what the officials thought. So I know there's probably precedent for DQing someone as opposed to time or fine or whatever, but I don't see any merit to the decision either. And now we have a Tour de France that's sort of marred by this incident where we also have somebody like Taylor Finney who's doing so well, and it's taking away from some of the other excitement of the race. Do you think this decision is going to affect the remainder of the tour?
Well, you know, yes and no. I mean, you know, where it affects the remainder of the tour certainly is the green jersey competition for the best sprinter. You know, Peter Sagan has won that hands down here for each of the past 5 years, and was you know, certainly the strong favorite to win it again here in 2017. So it opens up that competition. I mean, I think the absence of both Sagan and Mark Cavendish, you know, changes that sprinter's competition very dramatically.
And so, how is Taylor doing today? I don't know. I didn't watch the stage today.
How is Taylor Finney doing?
Yeah.
Well, you know, Taylor's had a great start to, you know, and you and I have talked many times about, you know, I was in the, I guess, the unenviable position of being in Chattanooga several
right.
years ago at the U.S. Pros when Taylor had what, you know, what really appeared at the time to be a career-ending crash.
Right.
So, you know, to have him in the tour is really amazing to watch. You know, he had a great first couple of days. He rode very strong in the opening time trial. And then, you know, what we can say of Taylor, you know, after that is that on stage two, you know, he ended up, you know, after having, you know, basically a top 10 finish on the first day, he ends up in the breakaway the second day. Came, you know, within a pretty close shot at actually taking the stage that day. But what he did successfully was take the points during stage two for the King of the Mountain competition. So he finished the second day of the tour wearing the polka dot jersey for the best climber in the competition, which I think if you had a chance to ask Taylor, and I'm sure you will at some point, he would tell you that's probably not what he expected. This was an interesting strategy by the Cannondale team, but what a special thing to see Taylor, you know, wearing the polka dots. He actually lost the jersey to a fellow American teammate, Nate Brown, the next day. So, they, you know, Cannondale definitely is doing something right there to get those guys the attention they deserve.
There are a couple of things about bike racing right now, pro racing, that I want to run by you, and it hasn't to do with just the Tour de France. It has to do with
sure.
all of these races, and that is, do you see that the leadership, which changed a couple of seasons ago and yeah. allegedly was going to make major changes, has been successful or not?
That's a tough question. I think we went. You know, you're referring to the UCI, the sports governing body. We
right.
had a past president in Pat McQuaid who was very controversial and, you know, as you mentioned, was sort of ousted from that role by a vote several years ago. Brian Cookson of Great Britain has taken on that role for the past couple of years, I think, with a lot of promises. Cookson, in my estimation, seems to be a good guy, but, you know, his connections to British Cycling and, you know, by association with Team Sky certainly don't help him with, you know, some of the accusations that were made about Brad Wiggins in particular. And you know, and Dave Brailsford, their team manager. So, you know, it looks as though there may be some credible challenge to Cookson's leadership here coming up at the next election, but we'll have to see.
Okay. Well, you know, it's always some sort of controversy. This year, it's whether or not Peter Sagan knocked Mark Cavendish out of the race, and other years, it's doping. I just got off the phone with Brent Schrotenbohr, who is the USA Today journalist and who's following the Lance Armstrong case. Talk about another really interesting conversation.
Definitely.
Lots of controversy right now. Well, anything coming up that you are reporting on that is not the Tour de France right now?
That is not the Tour de France. You know, one thing that is coming up here, and you know, maybe by the time this airs, your listeners will have the chance to see, but are you aware of Tour de Pharmacy, the HBO documentary?
I am. I've been trying to get a hold of somebody at HBO, and they do not answer their email. But
well, I will tell you, I've seen it.
And?
It is hysterically funny, as you might imagine.
I imagine.
You know, I wrote in an upcoming issue of Elle News a little bit about this. I was a little bit apprehensive. You know, I have taken on kind of a humor writing role with the magazine, and so I am certainly one who has on occasion made some jokes about cycling, but you know, they all come from a place of love of the sport and from a real fan's perspective. And so I have to say, I was a little worried about, you know, whether cycling needs a satire at this point to sort of cement
since it's its own satire, right?
you know, it frequently is. And so, you know, I was a little worried. I will tell you, you know, Tour de Pharmacy is awfully silly. It's, you know, it's very funny. I mean, I think fans will find stuff to laugh out loud at, but also places where they will cringe just a little bit, knowing that this is, you know, sort of the vision that the general public is going to get of the sport, and maybe have some of that image cemented in their minds.
Yeah, there has been a lot of pros and cons about whether they should have made the movie. I'm glad that they did. I think that we need to laugh at ourselves a little bit, right?
Definitely.
Right. Well, I guess we will have to keep watching the tour. We're only finishing up the first week here. We've got two more weeks to go. We'll see what other insanity is going to show up. And we'll stay in touch. I appreciate you taking time, as always, to talk with me about your knowledge of racing. It's so much better than mine. Thanks.
It's always fun. Thanks, Diane.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Dan Worry joined me from his office in North Carolina. It is always good to catch up with him. We'll take a look at his article in Velo News about Tour de Pharmacy. I had forgotten that it was coming up. It is airing on HBO, as I remember, tonight, July 8th. I don't know what time. So we need to take a break. We will be right back. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Back, and as promised, we're heading out to California to speak with Brent Schrotenbohr about the Lance Armstrong case. The trial is coming up this fall. Hi, Brent. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
It is my pleasure. And you have been covering the Lance Armstrong case for USA Today for a long time. We actually have not even mentioned his name in forever here. So it's interesting that I came across what you're doing, and I'm pretty excited about talking about it. Tell us a little bit about the background on the government's case and the upcoming trial in November, and then we're going to fast forward to the article that I read that actually got me to you.
Yeah, this is a case that actually originated in 2010 when Floyd Landis confessed to doping himself after denying it for a number of years and filed a complaint under seal in federal court against Lance Armstrong, Landis was acting as a government whistleblower. He's bringing this to the government's attention that the cycling team for the U.S. Postal Service had been doping, which was a violation of their sponsorship contract with the Postal Service, and that the team and Lance Armstrong in particular had been concealing those violations and lying about it in order to keep getting paid by the Postal Service. And so what this is, in effect, is a government contracts dispute, and the government joined Landis's case in 2013, shortly after Lance confessed to doping on Oprah Winfrey. The government joined Landis's case, and so now Landis and the government are working together against Lance Armstrong in a lawsuit that could amount to $100 million in damages for Lance Armstrong. He could be on the hook to pay all of that. And the argument that the government is making is that it paid Lance Armstrong cycling team $32 million between the relevant period of 2000 to 2004. And under the False Claims Act, it could get triple that money back in theory, and Lance could be on the hook for all of it. But this isn't a case about whether Lance or the cycling team doped or not. That's all been undisputed, and they've confessed to it. It's about whether Lance Armstrong, in effect, ripped off a government agency by causing false claims to be submitted for payment. And that's really what the issue is. And then the issue is, was, in fact, the Postal Service actually damaged by this conduct? And that's a whole other issue that could be very important in this case.
There has been a lot of speculation and I think some documentation that, in fact, the government probably didn't lose any money at the time that the U.S. Postal team was racing.
Yeah, that is a very big part of this case, and that's what Armstrong's attorneys have argued, that the Postal Service was not damaged at all by this conduct. In fact, that because of the cycling team's success, that they gained far more than what they bargained for, that this was a successful sponsorship beyond the Postal Service's wildest dreams. They got all that publicity that came when Armstrong was winning the Tour de France with the Postal Service jersey on his back, and that is the kind of advertising that you almost can't buy, and that's exactly what Postal Service bargained for. That is the argument that Armstrong's attorneys have made, that they got millions and millions of dollars in publicity from this, and it was very good for them. And therefore, they say that the government cannot argue that they suffered any damages at all, and that this case is really about nothing, except for maybe some statutory penalties that might apply, which would be, you know, not nearly as much as $100 million. It could amount to like $400,000 or $500,000 in civil penalties instead of $100 million in damages if Armstrong's case succeeds and a jury buys it. But that is, in fact, the issue of whether the Postal Service was, in fact, damaged by this is a big part of this case.
Well, when I look at the time period when Lance Armstrong and the Postal team was racing, I mean, we've got jerseys and bicycles and helmets and water bottles and all kinds of stuff with the United States Postal Service logos all over them. Seems to me they got their money's worth when it comes to PR.
Yeah, that's what Armstrong's attorneys have argued. Now, the government looks at it differently.
Of course they do.
they've made a few different arguments, and I don't know which one of them will stick. One is that they didn't bargain. What they bargained for was a clean cycling team that did not dope, and they did not get it, and therefore they did not get what they bargained for and want their money back. That's an argument that the government has made. Now, I'm not sure that the judge seemed to indicate he's not going to buy that argument, that the Postal Service wouldn't have sponsored this team at all if they had known the truth. And I'm not sure the judge seemed to indicate he's not buying it. And that lately the government has made a different argument, that there's been negative publicity associated with the doping after the fact, and they've hired experts to measure or count the negative impressions that have come to be associated with Lance Armstrong, and that reflects poorly on the Postal Service, and therefore it reduced the value of the sponsorship. It seems to be a lot more of a speculative argument and a harder argument for the government to make to a jury. I guess the juries might have to weigh what were the positives minus the negatives, and I don't know.
How would they do that?
Yeah, I know, and that's exactly what Armstrong's attorneys have said. Is like, how can a jury be asked to speculate and try to come up with some kind of formula where they weigh the positives of the sponsorship versus a negative and come up with a number? And that's a question that's at play right now in the recent back and forth in the case. The pretrial arguments is that Armstrong's attorney wants the judge to keep the speculation out of it, and he wants more of a scientific, evidence-based theory to proceed, and I'm not sure that the government has that.
So let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Brent Schrotenbohr. I hope I said that correctly.
Pretty close. Schrotenbohr, yeah.
Schrotenbohr. Oh, even better. Okay. So, and we are talking about the Lance Armstrong trial that is actually scheduled for November, which seems to be coming up pretty fast. There's a lot of anger and upset and accusations, a lot of new filings. Mr. Armstrong's attorneys want testimony from Betsy Andreo and Greg LeMond to be excluded from the trial. And I'm not sure what Betsy and Greg will actually lend to the government's case as opposed to take away from Lance's case. But what do you see with that? That seems to be really right up right now.
Yeah, the Armstrong's attorneys have asked the judge to exclude testimony from Betsy Andreu and Greg LeMond and others. This is part of the trial or the pretrial proceedings where each side tries to exclude certain evidence from being presented to a jury. And that's where the case is right now, before trial in November. And Armstrong's attorneys argue that Betsy's and Greg LeMond's testimony is not relevant to the case. They don't want to give Betsy Andreu a quote unquote soapbox to criticize Armstrong anymore. Now, the government would argue that Betsy's and Greg LeMond's testimony is relevant. Betsy LeMond, in particular, you might know the history here, where she overheard in the hospital room in Indiana, I think 96, of Lance admitting to doping, and that she would be the government sees her as a direct witness to his conduct, and as, you know, the wife of Frankie Andreu, who is a teammate of Lance on the Postal Service cycling team. So the government sees her as a very relevant witness. And lately, in the aftermath of Lance's confession on Oprah and everything, she has become more of a very sympathetic figure in this. You know, she used to be really take the brunt of Lance's criticism, and he would try to paint her a certain way, in a very negative way. And then after the truth came out, Betsy's become, you know, quite a sympathetic figure, and she's, you know, somebody that a jury might be able to relate to. And I think that's why the government wants to put her on the stand.
Sure, I can see that. How does Floyd Landis figure into the upcoming trial, if he does? I think the government wants Floyd Landis not to be part of the trial, whereas Armstrong's side wants nothing to do with Andreu and LeMond.
Yeah, it's kind of a messy, kind of a weird situation with Floyd Landis, because Landis is, in fact, working hand-in-hand with the government. He is the whistleblower who originated this case. He stands to gain financially if the government wins the case. Let's say the government succeeds with its whole case and gets exactly what it wants, $100 million. Landis stands to get 25% of that as the whistleblower who originally brought this case in 2010. So he has much to gain from this. He's working hand in hand with the government. And the thing about it is, the thing that makes it weird is that the government doesn't want Landis on the stand. They don't want their own whistleblower on the stand, which is kind of weird. And the reason they don't want him on the stand, as you might be able to guess, is they don't want to open him up for the kind of cross-examination or critical questioning that Armstrong's attorneys would go after with him, and that is that Landis is, in fact, a confessed doper just like Lance is, and in fact, Landis was the target of a different government fraud case back around 2012 when, you know, he raised money to support his denials and defense when he was accused of doping in the 2006 Tour de France. He denied it for all those years and raised money, more than $400,000, to defend himself in that case. Well, now we know that that was all false and that the doping accusation was in fact true, and that in fact he committed fraud against all those people that gave him money to fight the case, and entered into a deferred prosecution agreement in 2012, which he agreed to pay back the donors the money. And I don't think he's done that yet. I think he's got a lot of outstanding debt on that too, and I think that's something that Armstrong's attorney would like to bring up. So you can see that there's some credibility and character issues with one of the government's main people in this case, the person who originally brought this case, has many of the same character issues that Lance does, and the government would be happy to keep that all out of the trial and away from the jury to avoid, like, you know, muddying up its case. And that's why we're seeing some fighting about that right now.
It seems like a three-ring circus. It's really weird. I know that the trial in November is really singling out Armstrong as a ringleader. So they do know that all these other people kind of went along and doped, that they were all postal team riders. And yet they're really pushing for Lance Armstrong to be the one to sort of take the fall for all of them as the ringleader. What can you say about that? What do you know about that?
Yeah, that's a question that's been an issue in this case, too, because the government, when it joined Landis's suit in 2013, it sued only three parties. One was Lance Armstrong. The other one was Tailwind Sports, which is a company that owned Armstrong's cycling team but no longer exists. It dissolved as a company in 2007. And the third party that was sued by the federal government of the United States was Johan Brunel, the cycling team manager. Now, he is not a U.S. citizen, and he has not responded to this case. And because of that, he is considered in default on this case. But what that means is I don't know if the government would ever be able to collect on him if it wanted judgment against him. But in effect, where that leaves us is Lance Armstrong is the sole defendant being sued by the federal government, even though he was just one member of a cycling team that committed many of these same doping violations, whether it was performance-enhancing drugs or blood transfusions, which were in violation of the contract and the rules of racing, et cetera. Question is, why are they singling out? Armstrong's attorneys have asked, like, why are they singling out Lance at a time when doping was rampant in cycling? Why are they going after Lance? And the answer the government has given is, well, Lance benefited the most from all this, from this alleged fraud, that he was the ringleader of it, that he ran sort of a dictatorship where he made sure his teammates were doing what he wanted and went through all these machinations to get everybody on the right doping program, and he was the one that was ordering it all, and most importantly benefited the most financially from it, and that is the reason why it is going after Armstrong and not the rest.
Wow. Well, we've been reporting on this case for about as long as you have been looking at it. It seems like it's been going on forever. Have you formed any opinions as to who might actually come out on top on this case?
You know, I think the damages argument is going to be is a hard one for the government to win. As far as, was the Postal Service actually damaged by this, or did it get exactly what it bargained for when it signed its sponsorship deal? That's going to be a hard argument for the government to win. I mean, I could see an outcome where Lance, in effect, loses the case but doesn't really have to pay anything because of that. And so then if that's what happens, if this is where this ends up, where Lance is found guilty of causing false claims to be submitted to the government, he loses on that, but his penalty to pay on that is only like a six-figure sum, then I think he could claim victory even though he lost.
Yeah.
And I think that might be where this is headed. And we could also see that this could drag out even more if each side appeals, which is very, I think Lance will definitely appeal if he loses. And I think the government might too. And this could end up in appeals court and drag out another few years as well, as if we can't get enough of it, everybody. But that's where I think that's a very possible outcome, is he could lose but win in a way, by not having to pay much. And the damages argument is a very high hurdle, I think, for the government to scale.
Well, it has certainly been interesting to watch. It's going to continue to be interesting to watch. I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me. I take it that this is like one of, I know you, this is not your only assignment. You do lots of other things for USA Today. I don't know. Is this the most interesting case you've had?
Well, I cover a lot of interesting legal conflicts, but yeah, this one has been, because of the It is the U.S. Justice Department, in effect, suing Lance Armstrong. The title of the case is the United States of America versus Lance Armstrong. That's some pretty big heavyweights going to court and at each other for a number of years. And so I think that the high-profile nature of it and some of the interesting arguments in the case are very nuanced and complicated, and where you can kind of see both sides' point of view makes it really, really interesting to me. And so, yeah, it has been fun to cover.
We will, of course, keep watching it. That is our job here at The Outspoken Cyclist. And I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today about it. Are you a cyclist?
I'm not. I don't actually. I cover a lot of, like, sports business, sports legal issues. I have not covered the Tour de France. Like a lot of my colleagues have covered the races. I'm mostly covering the fallout. What's happened from that period back from the mid-2000s or so.
Well, this year has been no different. It's filled with controversy. I thank you so much for talking with me today. Have a great day, and we'll keep watching the case. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Brent Schrotenbohr joined me from his office at USA Today. Interesting conversation. We will, of course, be following the trial, and leading up to it, we'll see what else Brent has to say. We need to take a real quick break, and then we'll be back to talk with Bob Mianski about a most unusual case. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit doddcamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
And as promised, we're heading out to Portland this time to speak with attorney Bob Mianski. Hi, Bob. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's nice to speak with you again.
Great to be on here, Diane.
Well, it seems like we have a lot of controversy this week in the bicycle world, and I'd like to discuss the case of, and I hope I say her name correctly, Nako Makatsuka. She was struck from behind, sued by the driver's insurance for damage to the driver's vehicle, and it seems so backwards. Can you fill us in a little bit about what happened and what you think happened in this case?
Yeah, this is a story out of California. It's been going around a while now, but it seems to be being revisited by everyone, and you know, some indignation about what they read. And of course, like anything we read, we don't have all the facts. And but it is an outrageous story. And essentially what happened, as you said, she was hit from behind by a motorist that was negligent, caused her injuries. And then sometime later, she received a bill for the automobile repair, which is pretty standard operating procedure. And we can get into that a little bit, why that happens. You know, outrageous case. You know, she was due compensation for all her damages, and that would include anything that happened to her because she was hit by a car while she was riding her bike legally. And, in fact, she got a really poor result. So part of the reason was that the police report wasn't filed, and there's some questions about, you know, her representation. So it's a bad story. It's a good example for all of us, especially cyclists, so that we can make sure we don't go down that road.
So I guess the first question I have is, why would the police not file the report that they took?
Well, I mean, it's a bureaucracy, right? Los Angeles is 40 miles across. It's a massive city, and it's just another day at work for these guys and gals, and sometimes things slip up. It seems like a pretty big slip up when you have several squad cars and an ambulance and a fire truck showing up that there's no police report, but I don't know. You know, this is one of the questions, along with a bunch of other questions, which would require an investigation and due diligence by the person that's injured or by their representative. So we don't have these answers. But based on the article, and that's all I can go off, I don't know who represented her. And this is a bicycling magazine story.
Right.
But it seems that at the end, there's a bit about Nako speaking about what her attorney told her. And essentially what she was told was that, you know, she could go to court, but she'd have to pay more, that the other individual had insurance coverage, so they'd get paid. She had paid representatives, because that's what happens. When you have insurance, your insurance, you have a contract with your insurance company, and then they have a legal duty, a contractual duty, to represent you if you get sued. And so her attorney told her, told Nako, that she, you know, she would have to pay. And I think that's in reference to the costs of litigating the case, which gets to the meat of the matter. If you're an attorney and you're representing somebody on a case and you don't believe in the case, you don't want to try the case, because you'll put a lot of your time and resources into it, and you're not going to get any return. You might even lose. There's no reason that an attorney would lose this case, so it wasn't really good advice. I'm not sure. You know, we're only speculating at this point, but there's a couple things that are that we can take away from this story. And one of them is, yes, that insurance companies will come after people that they have to repair the car, and then they look to get reimbursed. So as a matter of a pattern, they just automatically, if they don't have an open claim, they'll just send out a letter saying, oh, by the way, you know, we repaired our insured's $4,000 car damage, and we want you to pay for it. Which tells me something. It tells me that she hadn't opened the claim yet, which is one of the lessons for our listeners. When you're involved in an injury, people assume that, you know, the government is involved when the police show up, that the wheels will start to turn. But in fact, there's no way for the insurance company to know that their driver hit someone until their driver tells them, which are contractually obligated to do within 24 hours. If you're involved with an injury claim, you have to tell your insurance company. But drivers don't do it, and it's very common. So I tell cyclists, you know, you might not want to talk to the insurance company right away. You might want representation. But one thing you should do is put them on notice of the claim. And you just call their 800 number. You talk to an operator. You give them your name, the driver's name, their license plate numbers, and they'll assign the claim. And now they're apprised of it. They'll start an investigation. They'll ask for the police report. So things are underway. It seems to me, based on my reading of this story, that that didn't happen, which left her in the position to get her first communication from the insurance company saying, hey, you owe us money. Then she gets an attorney, and her attorney doesn't seem to believe in the case, either because she didn't have big enough damages, or, you know, they thought they couldn't win the case on liability, which is remarkable based on what we've read, that she was hit from behind while riding legally. If the attorney had filed the case, they could have done depositions. They could have deposed everyone involved and gotten to the bottom of the story. And then the insurance company would have to figure out how they're going to defend their driver. More than likely, they would have agreed to pay some fair amount of damages.
I guess one of the questions I have, and I know as a driver that you are obligated to let your insurance company know if you are involved in an accident. And I'm not understanding why a driver wouldn't do that. And then go to the insurance company and claim that she backed into the car?
Diane,
yeah.
We're going to call them collisions from now on.
Yes, that's true. No, you're absolutely right. They're crashes. They are not accidents.
We've had a whole lifetime of using that word, and that's one of the ones that I have no problem not using, but, you know, I understand the issue, right? It's a part of our language, but
true.
We need to, and I know you're on my side on this. So.
Absolutely.
Just giving you a little hard time. But anyhow, so there's this collision. Why would the driver do that? All right, here's one of the things I tell people when they contact me. They say, well, listen, I got hit. My bike's destroyed. I got some medical bills. Do I need a lawyer or not? And I say, well, you might not need one. You know, you're probably not going to need one based on what I'm hearing. But have you seen the police report? What I've learned is that due to human nature, people at the spur of the moment are very honest. I'm sorry I didn't see you. Oh, it was my fault. Then a day later, they mull it over. They talk to their spouse and a couple friends. They start to get worried about getting sued, about insurance rates. And then they start to have this new perspective. Boy, that guy sure was moving fast. We came out of nowhere. And so what they do is they change their version of events to try to save their own skin, which is remarkable because why are we paying all this money into the insurance system? It's to cover people's damages when someone makes a mistake or is negligent. And then they do that, they injure someone, and then they try to get out of it. They try to, you know, they short shrift the person that they've injured. So what I tell people is, you know, don't believe it. Unless they gave that statement to the police or a witness, don't assume what version is going to get to the insurance company.
Interesting. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with bike lawyer, Bob Mianski. We're discussing a case that happened in California of a young woman, a triathlete, actually, evidently a competitive triathlete, who was injured, hit from behind, and then sued by the insurance company for damages to the car that hit her, which it just seems like such a bizarre case. So we have a collision, a crash. We have an injured athlete, which is really distressing to me, regardless of the damage to the bike. I mean, the bike obviously was damaged. We can replace bikes. She actually suffered for quite a while, from what I could tell from this. And so one of my questions is, did she go to the hospital? Were there ambulances? All of that. I'm not understanding. And of course, you're going to say, well, she may have been misrepresented. What happened here that she was so scared that she wouldn't pursue this?
I think that based on the story, and again, you know, we don't know enough, but I do see some similarities here in some of the cases that I've worked on and people in our bike law network have worked on. And in fact, I talked to the group about this case. You know, I talked to people in all corners of the United States. And in fact, I was talking to Lori Boxer McComber, who's in the other Portland, Maine. And she's a bike lawyer up there, and she points out that one of the issues here is that this is not an anomaly, that these kinds of police mistakes, I guess, are common, that people don't take our mode of transportation seriously and the police don't take it seriously, and it creates an uphill battle with the insurance companies, and it leaves an opening for them to defend cases they wouldn't otherwise be able to defend. And further, Lori points out that this lack of police reporting, lack of diligence, not only hurts the individuals that are already under, you know, a lot of stress from being hit and having damages, but it hurts the communities because we're not getting the statistics that we need to show that, you know, our mode of transportation, you know, people on bikes, you know, the stats aren't coming in for when we're injured and why we're injured if the police reports aren't accurate. So this is a great problem, and I don't have the complete answer. One of the things that our network does is it goes out to the police in their community and gets to know the officers and offers to, you know, put on a legal education on cycling and cycling law. And they're very well received when they do these, remarkably well received. And that has a big impact. And so that's one of the things that we can do as attorneys. It's hard to know what the public can do, but be your own advocate. You know, get an attorney right away, or if you're going to represent yourself, make sure that your statements are in the police report. A lot of times, police will show up in the hospital and hand an injured cyclist a ticket. How can that happen on a case like hers that could have happened in a situation like this? It didn't, but it happens all the time. They never took the cyclist's statement. You know, they were hauled off in an ambulance. So at the scene, they heard from the driver, maybe their passenger. Maybe a witness gave a neutral statement, and the officer decided, well, then the cyclist must have moved over in front of the car and issues a ticket. And then that really creates an uphill battle for us, sometimes insurmountable. If we only have our cyclist version and two witnesses that getting it wrong, we're really in trouble. We have to look for cameras, which is another thing that cyclists are doing, but also they're mounted everywhere these days, as you know, and maybe even at intersections. So that's something you need to check. In other words, if the police aren't going to do their job, you're going to have to do it for them. So you're going to have to be your own investigator, which, of course, isn't always possible for the injured cyclist.
You mentioned it, and I was going to ask if this has been helping these cases, and that is if you actually put a camera on your bike and you are recording what is going on, has that helped in specific cases in the recent past?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
It's happened many times. And in fact, in our network alone, we have, I think it was Brendan Kevinitis, who also had a case where one of his cyclists, he's out of Chicago, Bike Law, Illinois, he got hit. He got a cyclist that was doored, and then the insurance company came after him for damage to the door. And, you know, Kevin Brennan was able to win that case, get them to drop it. Generally, we can get them to drop these claims for property damage because they realize not only are they not going to get their money back that they had to put out for their insured who caused the collision, but they're going to probably have to pay damages now for the bodily injury claim, lost wages, property damage, and anything that's out of pocket and pain and suffering. So the first thing they do is withdraw their claim for property damage. So that's helpful. But if you're not represented, you'll have to prove your case and have enough evidence. And, you know, it can be quite intimidating. I'm trying to think of a case. We have a couple others where, the insurance company, the cyclist got a ticket. Insurance company denied liability, came after the cyclist for property damage, and then the attorney found a video of the incident from a hotel or a loading dock. And yeah, that just reverses everything. And you can have the camera on your bike. I mean, my position, and I think it's the position of a lot of us, is that, you know, we shouldn't have to have a camera. I mean, the roads should be safer, but if you want to protect yourself, it's a form of evidence, and I don't see any harm in doing it. I have a front and back. I'm just starting to use them now more so that I can blog about the different driving, cycling challenges that we face. And, you know, I don't even think that I'm going to be recording my own collision. That's not really my mindset, but it's certainly, I have been hit before. And if I get hit now, I'll have a video of it.
Your bikelaw.com website is very, very helpful. So you do have a page called Learn, and it includes the attorneys, the culture, the blog, the pro bono, all the things that you are able to do, including what to do during when you are involved in a crash. And there's an interesting map on your site too that shows all the places where there are bikelaw.com attorneys. The network has grown considerably since the last time you and I spoke. It's unfortunate that we need it, but it looks like it might be doing some real good.
I'm glad you think so, and I concur with that. I mean, it's a privilege to be a part of the group, because one of the things is to be a part of our group, you have to be a cyclist. I mean, that's not a hard rule, but you have to be a cycling advocate. You have to give back to the community. But that's easy because everybody loves riding that's in the group. They've joined the network because of the camaraderie, the shared resources, and because they love the culture. And that's been the focus from the beginning when Peter Wilborn started this network. And it's all been about cycling first. And then we got these fine attorneys in all these states. And when I talked about these facts, everybody scratched their head, and they gave me examples of what they've done in their respective jurisdictions. And it's quite impressive. I'm sure this would have been a different result. I can't really speak to what happened, and I'm sorry for the individual that had this happen to her, but I think the only good thing that came out of it is that people are apprised that it's not an easy situation and that you really need to know what you're doing. I don't think you have to have an attorney if you have a small case. In fact, I help many, I would say getting close to 1,000 people settle their own cases, and I'm going to continue to do that. But unfortunately, we have these other ones that require a lot more work. You know, until that day comes where these kinds of collisions are rare, we're going to keep plugging away for people on bikes.
Well, Bob, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. Again, it's bikelaw.com. I'm speaking with Bob Mianski. He represents the community of cycling attorneys in Portland, Oregon. And let's keep the rubber side down, shall we?
That sounds great, Diane. Look forward to talking to you again.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Cycling attorney Bob Mianski joined me from his office in Portland, Oregon. You can find out more about bike law and the attorneys that represent and assist cyclists at bikelaw.com. Instead of taking a break, I'm going to play the next story from the National Bicycle Challenge. It comes from Dusseldorf, Germany, by Gernot Soter.
Welcome to my first and probably the only story for the National Bike Challenge 2017 that I'll put together, this time actually coming from Düsseldorf, Germany. My name is Gernot Soter, and when you're surprised about this podcast coming from outside the US, that's actually what I'll explain first. And then second, what's so special about Düsseldorf these days? And those of you that are at least a little bit in race biking, you probably know the most famous and the most prestigious race bike in the world, the Tour de France, will start this weekend. And Düsseldorf is hosting the event. For the first time in 30 years, the Grand Départ of the Tour de France will be in Germany. And we're all very excited. And it's a huge thing here for us, for the city, for biking in general. So I'll talk about it for a few minutes.
Well,
coming back to the original question, why can we participate in the National Bike Challenge, although not located in the United States? As you know, the National Bike Challenge is initiated by the League of American Bicyclists, and it's actually open for employees of US-based companies around the world. So 3M Company, being the sponsor of this year's event, has a pretty large coverage worldwide of subsidiaries, and here in what we call the DACH region, which is Germany, Austria, Switzerland, probably one of the biggest subsidiaries of the company. We have about 7,000 employees in the region, and all of them basically are able to participate, and we try to encourage our colleagues to do so with the same intentions as you have, so promoting bike riding as part of your daily life, commuting to work, running grocery stores with your bike instead of using car all the time. Hopefully, eventually, we will bring biking here in the area also to the levels that we have in our neighbor country in the Netherlands. Conditions are good. I mean, the area here that we are located is called Lower Rhine area, or Niederrhein in Germany, which basically means it's flat. It's a fairly flat landscape. It's ideal for biking. We have moderate climate. We hardly have any snow or ice in winter time, so it's easy to use your bike all year round. The same intention actually had the mayor of Düsseldorf when he tried to bring the Tour de France and the Grand Départ.
It has been
quite controversial discussion about the Tour de France coming to Düsseldorf. It does involve like cost of a total of 13 million euro now, of which half must be covered by the city of Düsseldorf. So not everybody is bike friendly and wanted to give that money. But I guess that's all done now, and now we look forward to the event. The teams arrived yesterday in Düsseldorf. We have greeted them and celebrated them at the central place in the city. And tomorrow on Saturday, stage one will start around lunchtime with the time race. And then on the Sunday, we have stage two with one first climb up to the what we call the Grafenberger Wald area, and then going through the city of Neuss, where 3M offices are located. If we come to work on the Sunday, actually, we could see the tour passing by from our offices. It's so close, actually. And then stage two will end in Belgium, Lüttich, Belgium, after about 230 kilometers. So there's a huge excitement going on in the city. Lots of entertainment, lots of event already in recent weeks in preparation of the event. And hopefully all this initiative will increase the awareness also for cyclists, encourage more bike use, and we'll have fun. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the summer and keep on biking. Goodbye.
I want to thank Gernot Sauter for submitting his bicycle story to the National Bike Challenge. Remember, you can still join the National Bike Challenge at nationalbikechallenge.org and record your miles and get in on all the fun. I'd also like to thank my guests, Dan Worry, Brent Schrotenboer, and Bob Mionski for joining me on the show this week. We'll have another great show for you next week. Stay safe out there, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.